welcome back to another week of the Geek Whisperers. My name is John Mark Troyer.
And I'm Amy Lewis.
And I'm Matt Brender.
Each week we talk to a different person about what the heck they're up to, how it relates to, I don't know, enterprise IT, technology, their career, all that sort of good stuff, and we get their story. This week we're really pleased to have with us Dom Delfino, our special guest. Dom, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. How are you?
I am really good. So Dom Delfino, what's your actual current, I guess maybe not your geographical location, but your logical location, what are you doing these days?
So I am currently the Vice President of Worldwide Systems Engineering for Networking and Security at VMware.
So a short title.
Yeah, the short title. I lead the SE team at VMware for Networking and Security.
Yeah, which at this point is that, I mean, we're not going to get into the product here. That's basically NSX?
That is basically NSX, yes.
Okay. So Dom, you're in sales engineering, sales engineers. I take it you came up from engineering, not sales, correct?
Correct. I actually started my career in IT, as it did most SEs who are in sales or pre-sales engineering today.
What's it like being an engineer in sales? I know a lot of my friends have done it. Sometimes you meet them a couple months later and they have this glazed look on their face like, I had no idea. And other times they flourish, and all the time they get a lot of frequent flyer miles. I don't know, how did you get into sales engineering, and did you feel like you had gone to the dark side when you made that jump?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great question. So, I had worked in corporate IT for a number of years, and then I went to a integrator, and I started there as a post-sales engineer, right? We called them project engineers at the time, and you would do implementations for customers on a variety of different projects. And I think the transition for me from corporate IT to an integrator was good because you got to work with a variety of different customers. So you didn't only see what you did in your own IT environment, right? So, well, I'll date myself a little bit here, but if you were running Exchange, you only got to see Exchange, right? When if you know you went from customer to customer, you got to see Exchange and CC Mail and Lotus Notes and so on and so forth. So,
Dom, I don't know about the last three you mentioned, but people do still run Exchange.
Yeah.
You're not dating yourself that much.
So I was about to date myself with the notes and CC Mail.
Well, that's interesting. You also mentioned the magic word right away, customers, right? A lot of engineers and a lot of IT people, sometimes we're introverts or whatever. We get kind of started in the basement or in the machine room, and we don't want to come out. But already then you were out and talking with customers.
Yeah. So I think I'm the type of person who has a very short attention span. So I couldn't do one. You know, I started my career as a SCO Unix administrator. You know, that was, you know, I couldn't do just that for a long extended period of time. I'd like to go learn different parts of IT, right? So, well, I started as a sysadmin, then I did a little bit of networking and then email and then messaging and databases and then storage and then routing and switching and security. And, you know, for me, that kept it interesting because I was constantly learning new things, not just the incremental new things in my own category, which is fine, right? You know, some people choose to do that and they want to stay very, very focused in one area. I wanted to move into different areas. You know, being a post-sales engineer was interesting because you got the opportunity to develop quickly, and you were almost forced to develop very quickly because you were getting thrown, you know, into the frying pan in front of a customer at all times. So you had to figure it out, right? You had to make it happen because, you know, not only was your company's reputation on the line, but your own personal reputation was on the line.
So Dom, I believe when we kind of classify sales engineers, they tend to fall into two buckets, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. There's kind of the field sales, the people that are going in person with customers, and then inside sales where you're on the phone a bunch. Have you done one or the other or both?
I've always been field engineering, customer facing. I've not done any inside systems engineering roles before. Neither have I managed a team who's done inside roles either.
No, it's great. I bring that up because I think they have very different trajectories. So I tried sales engineering for a brief stint, and it was an inside sales role. And I was told that field engineering was just something I probably would have enjoyed more, being in front of customers and really getting to know them from a face-to-face point of view.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, for me, that's what it's all about, right? It's getting in front of the customers, understanding their problems. How can you help them solve the problems? What are the use cases? And, you know, and it's not always technological problems, right? That's just a piece of it, right? There are operational problems. There are, you know, the layer 8 issues, right? We call those religion, politics, and finance in engaging with the customers. So there are competitive challenges that you face. So it's really, and this is why sort of SEs are weird people, right? We're quirky people, you know, so you sort of tend to take these people who came out of IT, right? You know, or did some form of post-sales implementation hands-on roles. And then you put them in this role where they're part sales or, you know, salesperson, and not really salesperson, but they sort of have to have good customer-facing skills, right? You got to be able to work with customers, understand their needs and requirements, and help translate them into a solution. You know, you got to be able to work with partners, both partners in terms of channel partners and integrators and ecosystem partners as well, to bring together a holistic solution for a customer. So we tend to be quirky people. We tend to have all these little bits and pieces of jobs that we combine together, we mush together, like making biscotti, and then we put it in front of the customer there.
Okay. You know, I have to jump in there. Let's just get right down to it. Is sales evil?
You know,
So I stole this phrase from John, but the slick back hair sales guy, right? And I don't necessarily think of SEs as that. How do you, either as an SE or as a leader of SEs, resolve some of that natural tension from go, 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 sell, sell, sell with, wait, that doesn't work?
Yeah, you know, and I think we always sort of refer to the SE as the conscience of the sales force, right? So you sort of have to balance out the slick back hair guy, right? With a conscience.
I've heard them referred to as jockeys, right?
Who is the SE is the jockey?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're the horse.
I think we're the horse. I don't think we're the jockey.
No, it's interesting because I always wonder, like, in the same way we've challenged our understanding of public relations and marketing as a practice at all, I think another way to ask the question is, why is sales necessary? Isn't the product good enough to sell itself?
Well, you know, look, if it is, you put it on a shelf at Walmart, right? You don't need a sales force, right? You need distribution and retail. So I do think that, you know, there's two sides of sales, right? There's obviously the selling side, right? You know, you're there to provide a value to a customer, and in return for that, hopefully garner revenue for your company. And then the other side of that is also to be an advocate for your customer, right? And I do think that that's sort of underestimated in the market as a whole. When you have a problem with a product and a technology, and by the way, you know, anybody who's been in the technology business knows everything has a problem, right? And if it doesn't right now, it will at some point. You have somebody to lean on to represent you as a customer back to that company, to the engineering organization and development organization and QA and test and support and escalation and into the executive team of that organization, who has your best interests in mind, because, you know, their livelihood is based on your success, right? Happy customers buy more stuff. I do think that, you know, obviously people have that sort of slick back connotation, and some of them deservingly so, but, you know, most of the industry is really not that way. And, you know, a large part of it, you know, everything is a sales problem, right? Product got dented in shipping, it's a sales problem. Software bug, it's a sales problem. Hardware malfunction, it's a sales problem, right? Really, you know, a lot of the role of that salesperson is to be an advocate for that customer within their own organization as well. And I do think that that's a bit undervalued by people, you know, observing this from the outside and not really directly into that sales customer conversation.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it's a harder gig than some of the product specialists realize, especially at a company like, you know, VMware or, you know, Cisco or EMC or whatever, a big one with a big portfolio. You end up having to know a lot about very many products, and you don't even have the time to go deep.
You know, that really does, it keeps it exciting though, right?
Oh, I was the same way with social media, right? I felt very a kindred spirit to the SEs and the TAMs because, again, we were all trying to just keep up. But Don, I want to take it back for a minute. You talked about the shift from being an IT engineer into post-sales engineering at a reseller. And that, like you said, you get to look into many different data centers, but then you switched over to pre-sale engineering. Was that a conscious decision? Did somebody tap you on the shoulder? Was that something you wanted to do? What we're setting up is career paths for others too, but how did that work for you?
Yeah, you know, great question. And I think, let me take one step back, right? So at the integrator I had worked for, which was a smaller company called Integrated Systems Group, was ultimately acquired by Dimension Data. We had something that we call the engineering evolution, right? And it was sort of this development plan for post-sales implementation, you know, hands-on focused engineers, where you had to be a desktop engineer before you could be a server engineer, right? And you had to be a server engineer because you needed to understand how NetWare printed using IPX RIP and SAP before you could route or switch IPX RIP and SAP, right? So it was really these building blocks that built off of each other that you built your skill set in order to grow. And I think for me, you know, and I did some fairly large implementations, financial services institutions, universities, service provider customers. And I do think that, you know, I did get to the point where I felt like, this is cool. I really do enjoy the hands-on thing. But what I don't enjoy is getting everything configured correctly and then sitting on the phone with Microsoft support or Cisco's TAC for 2 days trying to figure out, you know, some bug in their code, right? I didn't enjoy that part of the role. You know, I enjoyed really building the solution and deploying the solution. I didn't necessarily enjoy troubleshooting it and some of the ongoing mundane operational tasks of like upgrading firmwares and BIOS and you know, code revisions and service packs and hot fixes. To me, that was just annoying. But I enjoyed working with customers. I enjoyed designing and architecting solutions for them, with them, and helping them solve problems. So I made that transition, and you know, I tend to be a friendly guy no matter what Amy tells you. So I really enjoy those customer conversations and working with them closely. So for me, it was a fairly easy transition and sort of a natural one from having to, you know, being an integrator, having to work with different customers all the time on different problems and different use cases. It was an easy transition for me.
That just leads to the natural question of how on earth did you become an engineer with the extroverted personality? You're ruining all our perfectly good stereotypes.
You know, I think it's funny. I think you'll find almost everyone I know who is now a pre-sales systems engineer, right, or what you'll shorten as a sales engineer, has come from internal IT at some point in their career. Most people don't come out of college and go into pre-sales engineering. There are a few exceptions to that. Many of the big IT companies have associates programs that's basically an extension of college with a, you know, maybe a year's classroom training and then mentorships and so on and so forth. But most people in pre-sales systems engineering came from a post-sales implementation or IT background. So I think I actually sort of fell into this. I actually went to school for automotive engineering and, you know, my goal was to design cars. And then shortly after that, I figured out I'd need to move to Detroit. Not that there's anything wrong with Detroit. I have great friends in Detroit, but it just wasn't in, you know, in my cards at the time. So I sort of switched to a engineering science program, which was a bit of manufacturing engineering, electrical engineering, computer science. And came out of college and needed a job. And the first place I got was, you know, an entry-level computer job actually at Rite Aid Drugstores as a network analyst and a SCO Unix administrator. So, you know, and I think I sort of right time, right place was an interesting job. I learned a lot there. We, you know, we were probably one of the largest SCO Unix shops in the world at the time. So there was lots of SCO resources on site. And I've got tremendous amounts of training there and learn hands-on. And I really liked it. I really enjoyed what I was doing. So I sort of accidentally fell into it as I fell out of the automotive engineering program.
Nice, nice. I like those accidental transitions. Now you're a manager of SEs and a manager of SEs. What do you look for in the background of a good SE? I mean, we talked about some of the common path, that some real-world stick time, as they say in pilot lingo. What else do you look for in terms of, I don't know, skills or curiosity, or how can somebody stand out if they're applying to a company like VMware to be a pre-sales engineer?
Yeah, you know, so it's a great question. And I think my answer might deviate from what you expect a little bit. I think what I look for principally and fundamentally is probably what I'd look for if I was hiring anybody in any industry. You know, I look first and foremost for work ethic, motivation, ambition, the ability to be a self-starter, the ability to collaborate with other people. Those are things that I feel can't really be taught. You either have them or you don't, right? You can teach people technology, right? And obviously we look through, you know, for deep technical expertise, and we do an assessment throughout the interview process. People go through several technical interviews in terms of, okay, where do we think this person is? Where do they need to be? Is there a gap? How large is the gap? What type of training investment do I need to make in them? That's part of the merit of being an engineer, particularly in a focused specialty area. But I think more important, it's the soft skills that you really look for, because those are things that are much, much more difficult to develop or adapt to a certain situation than the technical skills are, right? You can send somebody to a class on configuring NSX, right? You can't send somebody to a class on having a good work ethic, right? Or the ability to collaborate successfully. They're just things that you tend to naturally have. Or don't have.
Everything I learned about being an SE, I learned in kindergarten.
Maybe you learned in the womb. I don't know, right? It could be genetic.
I'm telling you, you can spot the engineers John, they're the ones who are lining up the paste in a particular order. I know. I grew up, my brother's an engineer. So I'm telling you, I've been dealing with you people my whole life.
Yeah, yet despite what we're talking about, we brought up both that Dom breaks the mold on our stereotypical engineering background, yet also seems to be the exact mold of like the SA, SE role that we talk to quite a lot at Geek Whispers about kind of the social person, the eye contact nerd, as opposed to staring at your shoes nerd.
Oh, I like that. The eye contact nerd.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me about that is that I think a good chunk of what you're talking about is also quite trainable. I mean, there are soft skills trainings that are important to us. We learn how to communicate with people and build presentations and be better presenters at times. So how does training play into the role of an SE beyond the technical?
Let's talk about the technical for a minute, because I want to revert back to Amy's first question of, is sales evil in this aspect? You know, so I do think, and you know, this is sort of the reason we have SE leadership, and you know, there is a reason you don't have tend to have SEs working for sales managers, right? They'd probably all quit within the first year. But I've been asked many times by senior executive sales leadership, like, well, why do our SEs need training? You know, there's the old joke, you know, CFO says to CEO, what happens if we train our people and they leave? And then the CEO says to the CFO, what happens if we don't and they stay?
You're here.
Yeah. I do think that, you know, it takes hundreds of engineers, you know, if not thousands of engineers, years to build a product, right? An SE or even a, you know, an engineer, a hands-on implementation engineer is not going to learn that product, that solution, that architecture in a one-hour WebEx session, right? So I do think it's very important. You know, I stood up in front of my entire organization and made a personal commitment to them that at a minimum, I would pull them out of the field for 2 full weeks per year for technical training. Okay. And as much as 4 full weeks a year when we include soft skills training, right?
Wow, that's actually a big chunk.
Yeah, it is a big chunk. So you consider, you know, all right, let's assume people have 4 weeks a year vacation, right? I never get to take 4 weeks a year vacation, but they tell me that we have that. And then I'm going to pull them another 4 weeks out of the year for training, technical training, soft skills training. You know, maybe they'll go to a conference or something like that. So, you know, 8 weeks of the year, they're not going to be out there in the field doing their job, working with customers and driving the initiatives that they're supposed to be driving. They're going to be there developing themselves so that they're able to do that for many years to come.
What I'm really interested in is a couple things. It sounds like you do have a pretty clear formula in terms of training engineers, or SEs in particular, so they're at their best, so that you've got really the mathematical formula for the number of hours you need to have them both last and be in the field being effective. So what kind of guidance would you give someone else who's trying to set up a program, and what kind of case would you make for what the right balance is of time out, time in the field, and also division between technical and soft skills in terms of your training program?
Okay, so it's not something that you can mathematically quantify, right? So I do think that this industry, right, or anybody in the technology industry, or if you are a social media person, this is changing so fast that if you're not training your people at least twice a year, or at least every 6 months, they're probably not going to be able to keep up.
And right? Training by that, just to be clear, you mean in-person, hands-on, what is the right kind in your mind?
You know, it depends on the level of depth of the topic. I'm going to say that I'm getting 2 full weeks per year of instructor-led hands-on training. I think there's ongoing things that SEs in particular do on almost a daily or weekly basis that's self-paced or web-based or virtual typed training, right? There could be peer knowledge sharing. There's a variety of things these guys are constantly doing on a daily basis, given the level of complexity and the dynamics of our market. So, you know, but at least 2 weeks a year of hands-on instructor-led training. I would say probably a week a year. It tends to be maybe something more conference-based or seminar-based, or, you know, things like VMUGs or, you know, partner-oriented things. And then, you know, probably in some way, shape, or form, a week a year of soft skills-based training, right? Presentation skills, understanding, you know, how to interact with customers or how to collaborate effectively with partners, right? How to, you know, diffuse situations that are going the wrong way. Things of that nature are other things that we would do as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, how to podcast under fire, that sort of thing.
How to podcast under fire, yes.
No, I'm very interested. As much as you say there's not a mathematical equation, at a certain level, I feel like there's a max min range for you. And I think it's helpful to get people thinking about that.
There's also a pretty easy mathematical formula for how much it costs. And I'm sure you're asked to justify that cost, whether you have a mathematical formula to combat that or just kind of anecdotes.
There is definitely a cost justification. So I sort of set that baseline of 4 weeks per year. I will tell you one good data point to use is, you know, good hardworking people with a good work ethic will typically tell you how much training they need, right? So, you know, one of the important things to realize as a leader of a large organization is you're never going to be smarter than your collective team, not even close, right? And, you know, one of the things that we actually do for the 2 weeks a year that I pull my team out of the field is they will dictate probably 50% of the agenda based on what they're seeing at customers, what they're seeing with partners, what they're seeing with competitors, where they feel that we're lacking, where they feel that we're excelling, right? I mean, let's make sure that we can push the envelope in those areas as well. So you sort of take that, you know, that bi-directional mechanism for developing the training in the sense that, you know, some of that direction is going to come from those folks in the field, and then some of that direction is going to come from the folks in corporate, right? Product management, engineering, technical marketing, so, you know, so on and so forth. So that sort of tends to strike the right balance. And, you know, we actually take a sampling of the field and we say, okay, what do you think we need to know? And we just make up sessions, right? And we throw all these sessions on the dartboard. And we have obviously a certain time amount of time allocated, and we've got to, you know, you always tend to have more sessions that people want to hear than time available to teach all of them. And then you sort of, you know, we use a little bit of democracy, and we have people vote on what do you think is most critical, right, to our success in the field, right? And then we also get our corporate constituents' perspective on what do they think is most critical for us to know in the field. And that's sort of how we formulate the agenda for at least my 2 weeks a year where I'm pulling out what I call my tech summit, which is actually happening next week, by the way.
I'll take that as an invitation. It sounds really impressive. It sounds like a lot of coordination.
We're short on budget, so it's $5,000 a person to come. No.
He is a slick back sales guy. In all that training, and I love the concept of listening, because I love the concept of, you know, the collective wisdom, the sum of the parts being greater than the head of the organization. Two-part question. How much time do you spend on soft skills like social? Because you're very active in the social spaces. That's something you yourself have done. How much encouragement and training do you do for people to get into those spaces? And how much do you use your own personal time that you spend in those social circles bringing back ideas of what you need to train on, what the kind of pulse is out in the world, et cetera?
Yeah, you know, Amy, it's a good question. I don't know that I've sort of got that figured out. I could tell you right now that there's sort of not a very good baseline for that. There wasn't in my previous role. There isn't in my current role. So it's probably something we could use your help on. I think that you can sort of see that there's people who get it and do it and are good at it. And you could sort of see there's people who just aren't. And I don't think that, you know, that's something that we've quite frankly figured out, you know. So, and this is sort of the quirkiness of SEs. I would probably be a very bad marketing person, because I think a lot of it is, you know, at least in my personal opinion, a lot of it's subjective and it's hard to quantify, and marketing people have all these means and mechanisms they use to measure impact and stuff like that. And, you know, I still wonder, does anybody actually buy anything off of what people say on Twitter? It's definitely something that I think as an SE community that we use for more sharing of ideas, but it's not something that we measure very well. It's not really a outreach mechanism for us. It's more of a, here's a good idea, I hope you take it and run with it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us marketers just kind of just make it up as we go along too. you know, it's clear that social makes an impact in the overall sales motion in the world. It's much harder to make that statement about any one account, although, you know, you can always have anecdotal information. And I do believe the plural of anecdote is data. I'm that kind of a guy. Sorry, Matt. But
no offense, David.
I just did a little dance. Two versus one.
My numbers add up higher than the two of you. So
oh, touche.
Well, Dom, different question. We've talked about what makes a good sales engineer and that they're quirky. What kind of person doesn't make a good sales engineer?
Yeah, so I think when you think of a sales engineer, and if you took a spectrum and you put sales on one end of it and you put engineer on the other end of it, anybody at one extreme or the other doesn't tend to make a good sales engineer, right? If you know, and you will see that. Is that okay? Thank you. You know, I try to keep it as simplistic as possible for you marketing people. we should talk about, we have another podcast on where they fit in that spectrum. But anyway, so yeah, I do think that, you know, you sort of get the SEs who, and you can afford to have the SE on the E end of the spectrum, right? On the engineer on the spectrum, where you sort of have big, big, complex customers, and you have a multitude of engineers on a team supporting that single customer. And then you could sort of have pieces, different SEs sit in different spaces on the spectrum. And then, yeah, so you get the one guy who says, I want to do all the lab testing for the customer and configure everything and write scripts and understand, you know, and do API translation for them, right? And they don't want to go out and help build an ROI model or a TCO model for a customer, and they don't want to do presentations, and they don't want to interact with partners, channel partners or ecosystem partners, right? Well, you know, maybe you should think about going into a different role, or maybe there is a role for you in sales engineering in certain instances, or maybe, you know, you'd be better in a post-sales implementation type role. And then you get the other end of the spectrum, and it tends to be people who are either attracted to something more of a pure sales compensation package, or who are no longer interested in keeping up with the technology and the rate and the pace of which it's changing, and therefore, you know, are okay with moving on from their skill set, their technical skill set, and moving maybe more into a sales relationship management type of role.
Makes sense.
The ideal person is more in the middle E side of that spectrum.
Which also, yeah, makes them hard to pigeonhole, which again is a concept that we run into all the time. We're talking to people and talking about people that are hard to pigeonhole. But I guess that's what makes life wonderful. So in development engineering, there's this concept of a technical track and a management track. When you get up to past team lead and become a manager of engineers, you know, that's not for everybody, and it's a different track sometimes. And luckily these days we often have a track that's purely individual contributor on up to often something called principal or fellow or something like that. Does that exist in SE land? And again, when you moved over to sales management, or what do you look for in somebody who's going from an SE individual contributor to SE management?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because I think as individual contributors, and whether it be SE or even systems administrator or network engineer or any of those roles, we like being heroes, right? We like being the guy who saved the day, who fixed the problem, who made things faster, who made things cheaper, et cetera, so on and so forth. It's good being about me, right, when you're an individual contributor, right? And you know, through my work, the broader team will benefit, right? I do think, you know, one of the first things that you sort of realize as a manager is that it is no longer about you. And if you think it's about you, you're probably not going to be a very good people leader, right? And it's about the broader team. And, you know, you're going to be measured by the quality of your team and the success of your team. You know, particularly going from a technical role to a technical leadership role, you do have to be willing to sacrifice some of your technological skill set. And you got to be comfortable with that. And that's difficult at first, right?
Yeah.
I was a consulting engineer who took over a team of consulting engineers when I first became a manager. And I think way back then, I knew more than everybody on my team. And I was like, holy crap, that's not good, because I'm going to have to do most of the work, right? and it was true, right? One of the first things I did was call one of our salespeople and say, hey, what do you think of your SE? And she told me, I think he sucks. And until you fix him, you're my SE, right? So literally I became her SE. And to this day, she still calls me her SE. The important thing is now you have this team of engineers working for you. And you know, you want them to respect you. You want them to trust you. You want them to maybe aspire to be you in some aspects or ways. So if you don't understand anything about technology anymore, sooner or later, like, oh, my manager's an idiot. He has no clue what it takes to do my job. So at a minimum, at the conceptual level, you have to be able to sustain your skill set. So you sort of start out making this transition from this individual contributor to maybe parlaying a player coach role for a little while. But, you know, you can only sustain that for so long as well before you transition into a pure leadership role. And you do still have to sustain some level of conceptual understanding at a minimum, right, in order to be a valuable leader for your people.
At some point, you just get tired of, like, patch level this with patch level that, and but it doesn't do this. And remember the KB article. At some level, sometimes you just get kind of tired, I think, and go up to a conceptual level as opposed to like being up to speed on every single quirk of the current version of the products you're working with.
Dom, you mentioned that there's some sort of intermediate step that I haven't heard worded this way before, and I really like it. You said that in between the individual contributor and the sort of leader, or at least like official sort of manager role, there's a player coach role, did you call it?
Yes.
Yeah, can you go into that? Like, what does it feel like to be a player coach? And maybe in what kind of skills do you end up changing when you're in that transitional role?
It's the, you know, people tend to leverage their strengths. You know, maybe we also tend to ignore our weaknesses as being part of being a human being. I think that sort of happens naturally. You know, when you first become a manager or a leader, right, you obviously haven't done it before. It's your first time you're doing it. So, you know, you're not an expert at it. You're learning it. You know, like if you're a network engineer and then all of a sudden somebody makes you a manager of a marketing team, you're probably going to fail at that job, right? But all of a sudden, if they make you a manager of the network engineering team, you probably know what it takes to do that job. So I think that can sort of sustain you through this transition into the leadership role, right? You can leverage your strength there. Hey, my strength was I'm a great network engineer. That's probably why I got the job of being the leader of the network engineering team. But now I've sort of got to develop my skills around hiring and building a team and developing people and making sure that my organization understands the value of my team and contributing to the broader business efforts. And you sort of got to figure that out. So while you're figuring that out, you can still leverage your strengths that you have, your history that you have, your experience that you have. But ultimately, you've got to focus more of your time on building on your weaknesses, right? Or building on, you know, focusing on the areas that you need to develop in. So, and I kind of would say like a catcher in baseball is the best example of that, right? You know, so Joe Girardi manages the New York Yankees now. Not that the New York Yankees have the best example of success right now, but, you know, being a Yankee fan, that pains me. But, you know, when you look at what a catcher does in the context of a baseball game, right, they're not only sitting behind the plate, receiving the ball that the pitcher throws, they're calling the game, they're watching the base runners, they're looking for the bunt, they're relaying messages from the dugout. There's all of these different aspects that they're doing that is sort of almost a player coach role. And maybe, you know, I don't know statistically what the rate of baseball managers are that were catchers, but I think there's actually quite a few. And I think that's probably a good example of it. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense that you transition from that expertise and you start noticing, you kind of pick your head up and you see the system as a collection of people and processes that are interacting, and you start playing more of that role. And it is a natural jumping point to wanting to more formally lead a team. I just find it really interesting that you call it out that way, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And I will say one thing. Not always is, you know, whatever job role you're in, you know, whether it's marketing or engineering or whatever it is, or sales, right? Not always does a great salesperson or a great engineer or a great marketing person make a great manager. Now, I doubt a lousy engineer or a lousy salesperson is going to make great make a good manager of engineering or manager of sales. But, you know, and I think you do see that a lot of the time is we'll take the smartest engineer on the team and make them a leader, and they might fail. Right? Because, you know, being a really great engineer doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a great leader or a great manager.
Yeah, but people come in many colors and flavors. I am particularly pistachio and strawberry, for instance.
Well, we've got bacon, we've got sausage, we've got everything.
So, hey, Dom, we are in a time of transition in this industry. Maybe we always are, but it certainly seems like we're moving somewhere pretty fast these days. All engineers, all IT are looking at new technologies, the cloud, open source. They're making kind of profound shifts in the way we work and what we're going to be doing. You in particular are in the networking space, which is undergoing its own profound shift. Where do you think we're going in the future? What kind of skills will IT need in the future that might be different from today? And how should people be looking at this if they're just starting out, or frankly, even the folks in the middle of their careers, they've still got to stick around for the next 10, 20, 30 years.
You know, certainly the way government's going, we're not collecting Social Security anytime soon. So I think it's a great question, you know, and I'll tell you, you know, you meet with the spectrum of customers and you could sort of see the ones who are leading edge, who are embracing change, and the ones who are holding on to legacy. It's fairly evident when you get to meet with this spectrum of people out there. You know, I think one of the things that engineers that you'll see in IT organizations today, and let's just give an example, your individual contributor engineer in networking or virtualization or security or storage, I think those skill sets are evolving very, very quickly today. As a matter of fact, it's interesting how you'll go and talk to some customers and they'll say, hey, I'm the network guy or gal, and I'm the storage server guy or gal, and I'm the virtualization guy or gal. And then some of them will introduce themselves and say, hi, you know, I'm an enterprise architect or I'm an infrastructure architect. And I think, you know, as things start to blend together more, particularly at the infrastructure layer, you will see people have to become broader, not only be an expert in one aspect, but also have some level of expertise in the things adjacent to it as well. Secondarily to that, I think the days of us telnetting to a device and manually entering something or hot fixing something or patching something manually, you know, all right, so let's just roll back the clock, you know, 15 years ago, you bought a server and you opened the CD-ROM drive and you put your Windows CD in and you booted it. Those are long gone, right? And I think you see today, it's not just understanding routing protocols and switching and security and those things, but also how to automate them and provision them and orchestrate them and program them. So as we, you know, people, I think their skill sets are moving up the stack. They're quasi becoming, a piece of their role is becoming more development oriented. Maybe that's where the DevOps movement is coming from. And their ability to interface with developers, application developers in particular, is more and more important as well.
So Dom, you're saying we're not all screwed.
No, we're, I think the only people who are screwed are the ones who are holding on to the legacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could tell you, you know, I've had people work for me in the past, and as the market transitioned and new products came out, and they said, hey, you know, that's great, but I'm not interested in doing that. I really like what I'm doing now, and I just want to keep doing what I'm doing now. You know, you can do that, but, you know, at some point, you're going to need to learn something new, or your skill set's going to age out, right?
That is actually my question. I like to ask things in the negative. What would the skill set be? What would they do that would be like, you know what, we're not going to renew your contract, or where does somebody get cut? Where's that line?
Yeah, you know, people get cut when they can't transition. If you're an ATM engineer or a frame relay engineer at this point, or an X.25 engineer, or a, you know, I will tell you this, if you're a mainframe operator or administrator, you're in good luck right now, because so many people have retired out of that. There's actually high demand for those skills again, because there's nobody left around to do it.
yeah, makes sense. Just hold on long enough, yes, right?
You can hope that that happens.
that's one career strategy.
That is a career strategy.
Okay, well, here's my other favorite question, and I can't resist asking. We do lots of positive advice, and there's a million good nuggets in this podcast, but if you had to tell someone, don't ever do this again, take it from me, what is the piece of advice you would give them?
I'm going to give you a non-answer to that, because I'm going to sort of give you...
Wait, are you a politician?
No, I'm not a politician. I'm gonna give you a better answer than that. I'm gonna rephrase your question without telling you I did that.
you just did.
This is getting pretty meta, guys.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the one advice that I would have is be great at what you're doing right now, or there won't be a future. Right? And I see lots of people who are sort of stuck in their career and they can't get out, and it's for a variety of different reasons. But the biggest one is you're not great at what you're doing right now. So you're either doing the wrong thing, or you can't get out of what you're doing because it's the wrong thing, because you're not good at it. And no, everybody knows it, right?
That's really powerful, yeah. Actually. Yeah, you did answer it the right way.
I did. I just had to make sure that you understood the question that you were asking.
No, I think there is something really profound about that, and that people don't say maybe often enough. I have to tease you. Maybe that's the Brooklyn coming out. But people want to maybe change gears whenever they're not at their best. And there's a great saying of the best time to look for a job is when you have one, not when you've just been fired.
Yeah, and it's true. And I'll tell you, I've had people who work for me who've come and told me, you know, hey, I want to go do something different. And, you know, am I the kind of person who's going to go stick my neck out and call one of my peers somewhere else in the organization to help you get something different if you're not even doing a good job for me? Right. You're actually putting the people who can potentially help you in a difficult situation when you're not doing that. Right. I think it's very important to anyone's success to really give everything you do 110% all the time, and to at least try to be great at what you do, you know, if not actually be great at what you do.
Well, there's a quote, at least try to be grateful in what you do.
It's the polite way of saying you suck. No.
Well, you know, we all are starting from where we are, too.
Yes.
Yes. Hey, Dom, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much. If people want to grab you on the internet or connect with you in some way, what's the best way of doing that?
I mean, at Dom Delfino on Twitter. You can get me on LinkedIn. You know, those are the two most prevalent ways to do it.
Great, great. Thanks very much. This has been another week of the Geek Whisperers. Thank you. You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as Jay Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.